Hello, welcome to the Snooker Scene Podcast. I'm Dave Hendon. This week I had a chat with Andy Goldstein. He presents snooker on Eurosport. He also presents the sports bar on Talk Sport. He also went to school with a young lad who went on to become a very, very, very famous snooker player. I had a chat with Andy about life in snooker, his career as a presenter, and what it's like to be Jimmy White's babysitter.
Andy, when did you first discover snooker? Can you remember coming across the sport for the first time?
I can, yeah. I remember watching the 1984 final of the World Championships between Davis and Jimmy. I would have been 10 years old. And I didn't have a clue what I was watching, but I sort of felt drawn to it because of just how Jimmy played the game. And even though he lost, and he played brilliant in that final, even though he lost, I remember crying because the fact that all of a sudden my newfound hero wasn't champion of the world. And from that moment on, I was hooked.
Yeah, not the last tears following Jimmy.
Yeah, it's been a very bumpy ride being a Jimmy White fan, and very frustrating at times for so many reasons. But I wouldn't have had it any other way. There's no other player, I think, that has done for the game what Jimmy's done. You know, I know Higgins before and Ronnie after, and of course, you know, what Ronnie's achieved far outweighs anything Jimmy's done. But I just think in the era in which Jimmy done it, no one else had hit balls like he'd hit. No one else had the flair that he had. He didn't really copy anyone apart from Higgins, but I thought he took it to another level. So that's why I'll always be Jimmy.
Mm. And we were talking in the bar last night. Your first match that you saw live was a couple of real legends at the Masters.
Yeah, that was in 1987 at the Masters, at the Conference Centre. Cliff Thorburn against Willie Thorne. I think it's out on DVD now, that one. 5-3, Cliff Thorburn won it. And my dad took me and I bunked off school to go and see it. And I remember right early on, I think it was Alan Hughes was the MC, and he said just before the players came out, we've got a few empty seats if you want to come down. And I ran to the front two, right in front, like just behind where the trophy would be. And after the first frame, my dad realised that we were on telly. Mm. And we had to move back in case one of the teachers saw me. But it was great. I was hooked. You know, it's quite bizarre, Dave, because we're very lucky in our jobs that, you know, I'm sitting to you, talking to you in the commentary box, and we're looking out at the table for the final. And I still get the same buzz now. It's very bizarre, but looking at an inanimate object in front of us, which is like any other snooker table, but it just feels different because it's the one they play the final on. And I got exactly the same buzz when I was... how old were I in 87? 14 at the Masters, and I just stood there. I've still got pictures of me next to this empty snooker table. It was great. I loved it.
That's right. It's a very different experience going to a tournament than watching it on TV. It's a lot rawer, particularly the Wembley Conference Centre in the 80s. There'd be people smoking. Quite a rowdy place, really.
Yeah, and I couldn't work. The one thing that struck me, actually, was... So people listening to this might not know, but the snooker table that the players play on is completely and utterly different to any play you... any table you play on in your club. It's so much faster. It's like ice compared to the ones in your club. They're a lot heavier, the cloths are thicker, the balls are sometimes heavier. And what I couldn't believe the first time I saw two professionals play is just how lightly they hit the cue ball. Because I'm used to thumping it and trying to get the white, you know, from the blue area down to the yellow. You've got to really give it a whack. They just tapped it. And that I could not believe, just how much they don't have to do with the cue ball. And, it was probably about a 7-hour match knowing those two, but I could have stayed there for 17 hours. It was brilliant.
But of course, unbeknownst to you, there was a snooker player in your school, wasn't there? Turned out to be a very famous one.
Yes. So the story goes that when I was about 14, I was head and shoulders above everyone else when it came to playing snooker. And then this little pipsqueak called Ronnie O'Sullivan, who was 12, so I would have been 14, said, I'll take you on. And I was like, okay. And I went to his house. He lived in the road next to me, and I knocked on his door on a Saturday morning with my cue case in hand. And his dad answered the door, and he looked down at me because I was only however tall I was, 4 foot. And I looked up at his dad, and his dad went, "What do you want?" Mm-hmm. And I went, "Is Ronnie in?" And he went, "Yeah." And I said, "I'm here to play him." And he went, "How much?" And I thought, "What?" And I went, "Oh, no, £1." And he went, £50, or you can leave. And I've toned that down.
Yes. Yeah.
And I went, and he just slammed the door in my face. And I didn't play him that day, but then when I did play him up at Ilford Snooker Club for the first time, because that's where we both used to go, I just could not believe. In fact, up until that moment, I always dreamt of being a snooker pro. And as soon as I saw him play, I could not believe how good someone can be so young. It was utterly frightening.
But it's significant. He's 12 and you're 14. Because when you're like in your 40s, 2 years between you is nothing. But at that age, someone who's 12, if you're 14, they beat you. It's quite a sobering experience, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, it's not just beat. He hammered me. I mean, my highest break at 14 would have been maybe 40 or 50 on a great day. He was knocking, you know, tons as if it was going out of fashion. There's one story I've told a few times, but it just sums up what kind of kid he was. Where on table two at Ilford Snooker Club, which was the middle table, he was on 15 reds, 15 blacks, as a teenager, as a 14 or 15 year old. He did yellow, green, round, blue, pink, and on the black, he was plum on the black, and on the black, started taking out the balls. This was against me. Everyone at the club, there was the bar just to the left, everyone was watching. And he started taking out the balls. And it would have been the first maximum I'd ever seen. And I looked at him and said, "Are you not going to pot the black?" And without sounding flash, but in just a matter-of-fact kind of way, he just looked at me and went, "Well, I'm not going to miss that." And I just could not believe it.
But that's the difference, isn't it? Because like most people would, they dream of making a maximum. That's why they go to bed at night if you're a snooker player, particularly young, dream of doing it. He just knows he can, so why bother?
Yeah, just the way he controls that cue ball. You know, bizarrely, actually, I was talking to Ronnie, when was it? I think it was yesterday afternoon, about the days we used to play up at Ilford. And then we were talking about when he went to that qualifier and won, you'll know this, is it 38 matches on the spin? And I said, how would you compare your form then as a kid to how it is now? And he said, I was probably better then than I am now. And I know that sounds bizarre, but he was so fresh. And he just had, there was no negative thoughts in his mind whatsoever. And I know if you're listening to this thinking there's no way you can get a better Ronnie than the one we see today. But in a strange kind of way, it was just fearless snooker he used to play.
So tell us about Ilford Snooker Centre, because that's quite a legendary snooker club in sort of snooker history, isn't it?
Yeah, so when I went there for one birthday, the resident pro there was Eugene Hughes, and for one birthday my mum got me three lessons with him. And that was really my introduction to Ilford Snooker Club. And then they had great players there, apart from Ronnie. Ken Doherty was the club pro there. But they had players that a lot of you wouldn't have heard of that was still just head and shoulders above me. There was Nick Terry, of course, ex-snooker professional. There was a player called Billy Elf who used to play and knock in regular tons. Mark King played up there. People like Stuart Reardon, Stuart Parnell. These are all really, really top-class amateurs that I would have given my right arm to be at their kind of level, and even they didn't make it. And it was just a great place to go. You know, people would go up there. We talked about this actually all week. We've been talking to various players after they've won on the couch about how that doesn't really exist anymore. The fact that you can go up to a club at 10 o'clock in the morning with your cue, you can be there until 10 o'clock at night. You won't arrange anything, but when you'll get there, there'll be six or seven people to have a best of five. You'll have a bit of food, bit of kaluki as well, the telly will be on. You'll have a laugh, you know. It's like that dressing room feeling. And it was great, you know. I couldn't get anywhere near the standard of play with those, but you were sort of accepted into the Ilford Snooker Club family. It was fantastic. And quite a few of the barmaids were very attractive as well. So as a teenager going up there, you know, it was that was another reason why.
Well, I was going to say, though, because in that era, it was still, snooker clubs were still associated as being sort of smoky and a little bit dodgy in a way. A few ne'er-do-wells coming into your characters. Was there no sort of concern from your family maybe spending a bit too much time there?
No, they were just pleased to get rid of me. No, because they knew I loved the sport. And in fact, upstairs at Ilford Snooker Club, they halfway through my time there, so maybe when I was about 19, because it started becoming popular, they changed upstairs into nine ball pool tables. And I thought I'd give it a go. And on the first night I went up there, there was a competition, and I won that. And I thought, okay, maybe I'm more of a nine ball pool player. So then I continued playing nine ball. And I got to, I think, about 32 in the country playing. I played on the tour and I played in the World Championships, but sadly never got higher than 32. So they knew I enjoyed it. They knew if I was successful, you know, I could make a few quid, not a lot of money. But also, you know, being at Ilford Snooker Club meant I wasn't in the pub and I wasn't doing anything else that's dodgy or naughty. So they were quite pleased with me to go up there.
But you accepted seeing Ronnie, seeing Ken and the others, okay, I can play to a good standard, but I'm not going to be a professional. Have you accepted that yet, Andy?
No. Do you know what? I still sometimes think I could do a job out there. I know, Dave. I know it sounds crazy. But there will be times where okay, so sometimes here I'll practice with Jimmy on the practice table when we've got a bit of downtime, right? And he'll absolutely hammer me. He gives me 70 start and we play for a couple of quid, best of threes, right? And if I'm lucky, I'll take a frame off him, right, with a 70 start. But there are times sometimes if I'm practicing on my own, I'm thinking, do you know, if I play this well against Jimmy, I could beat him off level. It's maybe, I don't know, maybe it's just the dreamer in me, but Yeah, you very kindly voiced, we did a gag on Eurosport where you voiced me dreaming that I'd become, I can't remember what, if it was Scottish Open champion or whatever. But when I saw that, it was like, okay, another box tick. That's what it would sound like with Dave Hendon commentating. Right?
Well, I think it was the World Championship, because I think I have to say they'll have to scrape Stephen Hendry's name off it, which seemed, you know, a little bit over the top in some ways.
No, but... Dave, you said it from the heart. I know that's what you meant deep down.
Okay, so you didn't become a professional snooker player, but you went into broadcasting. So where did the interest start with that, and what was your sort of path in? Because there's no, I think people, they quite often ask maybe yourself and me, how do you get into broadcasting? But there's actually no one way into it, is there?
No, mine was incredibly late. I was 29 when I got into it. I always wanted to be a presenter, and this was before everyone wanted to be a presenter, before people saw Big Brother as a way to be famous. And I left school and I became an office junior and worked my way up to be an office manager in a publishing company. And for one reason or another, I went to various jobs and things didn't work out, and I found myself to earn a few quid in the post room at Channel 4. And I was there just as a temp for 2 weeks. And while I was there, I was in a club near where I live, and I bumped into an old girlfriend from school. And she said, "What do you do now?" And I said, "I work at Channel 4. And she said, "I was a presenter." And I went, "Yeah, that's what I do." And that was the light bulb moment where I thought, actually, maybe I'm in the building for a reason. And then on the Monday, I went to see Andy Peters, the TV presenter, who at the time was head of T4, and said, "This is what I want to do." And he told me I needed to make a show reel. And from Channel 4, I borrowed lots of videotapes, lots of jiffy bags, the editing suite, and I made my own show reel. And then I would come into work with a sports bag of videos to send out and put them illegally through the Franken machine, about 200, 300, and sent it off to various production houses, and eventually got a bite. And I got into snooker through when I was doing the All Sports show, on the Soccer AM All Sports show on a Friday for Sky Sports. They realised my love of snooker, and they asked me to do the Moscone Cup out in Vegas, and I did that. And of course, at the time, Sky had the Premier League snooker. And then the other people that did, I think the wonderful Dave Clark used to do it, but then it became too much for him when darts was introduced, and they asked me if I wanted to do it. And I just jumped in. And I'll never forget, so the first time I did it, Jimmy was playing. And at that time, I didn't know him, and he was still my idol. And he still is my idol, and he's still God. But I didn't know him, and I went into a changing room to put my suit on, and about 5 minutes in, there was a knock at the door, and the door opened, and it was Jimmy. And he was like, "Oh, hi, how are you?" And I was like, "All right, nice to meet you, I'm Andy, I'm presenting. All right, do you mind if I change?" And I was like, "No." And it was just me and him in there. And after about 10 minutes, I remember thinking, "Oh my God, I'm in a room on my own with my idol, and he's in his pants." It's very bizarre.
Yeah, I mean, it's a big deal to suddenly be presenting live sport, particularly a sport you've grown up idolising and watching.
Yeah.
But also, you know, it's a lot of pressure, because I remember the Premier League, you would present it in the arena, wouldn't you? There was no sort of studio off. You'd be out there, all the crowd are there. You know, and because you're relatively new to it, you've got to do it well. You have.
Yes, and I didn't. that's where I learned to cut my cloth. It was, I think when the Premier League went out, even though it was on Sky, it was just a little bit before people realised what they could do with pressing the button, stop, rewind, and then play again and video it and put it on social media.
Yeah.
So the mistakes that I made, sadly, hopefully are buried deep, deep in the Sky Sports vault. But listen, we all make mistakes. I still make them today. You don't make any, because of course you're up there with the best people. But that's how you learn, you know. And I think the advantage I've got in the snooker world is that I still play the game. You know, my highest break's 97. But all the players know that I can play, and they all know that I've got history with it, and they all know what I'm talking about. They know what I'm talking about is from years and years of being a fan, not just turning up on the day and doing my research and notes. So I think I get that respect from them, and that helps as well, because they know that when I'm talking to them, you know, they know I'm talking as a fan and a presenter as well.
Yeah. I was going to ask you, like, how you found sort of walking into it and getting on with the players, because if you are a fan, and there'll be people who are snooker fans listening to this, the idea of meeting, you know, a Stephen Hendry, a Steve Davis, they'd be nervous, wouldn't know what to say. But actually, what I've found, I'm sure you've found the same thing, is they're incredibly down-to-earth people. Even the stars don't act like stars.
No. I still get nervous sometimes. You know, I'm really good friends with quite a few of them now. That's a good question. You just get used to it. I mean, if you're... The difference is, when you see snooker on the telly, we haven't just turned up 5 minutes before they've played the game and then we all go home. You know, in the morning, we're here rehearsing, we're relaxing, we're all in the players' lounge, so you are socialising with these people. And then at the end of the night, we go back to the hotel and we go to the bar and we have a drink. And then so you're in each other's pockets. So that's how you become friends anyway in any industry. So it's just something that happens naturally. But I still, you know, I'm really good pals with Stephen. And sometimes he'll phone me and I'll be like, oh, Stephen Hendry's calling, you know. Not to that extent, but it's, you know, Hendry's like an absolute legend. So I suppose, you know, Jimmy tells me he's got mates with like Ronnie Wood, for argument's sake. And he'll sometimes go, Ronnie Wood's calling, you know. I think it's great. It's nice to still put these people on a pedestal because they deserve it because of what they've done for the sport.
Sure. So let's talk a bit about your job as a presenter. We're here, you're presenting for Eurosport, of course, at the Scottish Open this week. You talk about social media, everyone's got their opinions about presenters and I think a lot of people think I could do that, but they have no idea at all what's involved, because they may see that earpiece in your ear, but they've got no idea the sort of stuff that's been said down it. Obviously, you're listening to the producer, the director, they're asking you to throw to VT packages and or ask a particular question or look this way, look that way. Can you just explain what that's like and how long it sort of took to get used to that?
I still haven't got used to it.
But what are you hearing? What are you actually hearing in your ear?
So all the time I'm on air, I've got what's called open talkback. So in my ear will be everything that's happening in the gallery. And the gallery is where the producer, the director and everyone else sits. So the reason we have it on open talkback is because if I'm, for example, linking to a VT, and as I'm just about to do it, I can hear someone in the gallery shout out, oh, we haven't got the VT yet. I know that I don't link to it. You know, it's those sort of things, rather than just be told, don't link to it, and then you mess up as a presenter. So I've got all that going on at the time. You also have what we call hard counts, so you've got to get in and out of VTs and breaks when someone in your ear is counting 5, 4, 3, and you've got to hit that mark. But again, that's something that comes with experience of telly and also radio. You know, you do that a lot in radio. You'll have also, we had it this week, which I absolutely love. So we have a running order of the day, and it will say, you know, like 30 seconds on opener, and that's where you would say, big match today, you've got X, V, Y, and then it would say, envision, 3-minute chat about Ronnie, 2-minute chat about Sean Murphy, go into VT about Sean Murphy interview, and that sort of thing. But I can't remember what day it was this week, but for some reason, one match finished way too early, and the two players that were meant to be on the match table next hadn't even turned up. So we had to fill for 25 minutes. Yeah. And we had a great chat. Mm. And obviously, no one has got anything prepared. There's no VTs ready to play. So in your ear, it's just you've got 20 minutes to fill. Mm. And I think it helps massively that I've got a massive love for snooker. Mm. And, you know, if I can't fill with Jimmy White, Neil Folds and Ronnie O'Sullivan on the couch for 20 minutes talking about snooker, then I shouldn't really be doing the job. Mm. But it's those sort of things. You are literally flying by the seat of your pants for the whole time. But that's why I love live telly. We do highlights links for obviously every day in the evening. I think it's on Quest you have highlights for the day's snooker from before, and those links are pre-recorded, so while the evening session is on, I'll move into the practice room and I'll have to say, you know, welcome to Quest, here are the highlights from the... That takes me 6 or 7 times to get it right. And if it's live, I'll get it in one. And I hate doing pre-recorded. It's very bizarre. Mm. But I think subconsciously my brain is thinking, oh, you can muck this up, it's fine. But I absolutely love doing live broadcasting. It's good fun. And listen, the amount of fun I have on that couch with Jimmy and Ronnie and Neil, I'm very lucky. I'm not just saying this because I'm here now with you in the box at Eurosport. But out of all the companies I work for, to sit with those two on you, it's fantastic fun. We're very lucky. It's not really a job. I just get paid to do what I love.
Sure. But what also you were saying about, so you filled that 20 minutes, but then after the match, we normally get the winner of the match comes in, and I guess it's your job to sense what sort of mood they're in, because they're not always buzzing that they've won. Sometimes, I mean, John Higgins we've had in there before, and he's sort of down in the depths of despair.
Yeah.
And it's your job to sort of judge that and work out, I guess, the best way to get out of them what you feel they want to say.
Yeah. Sometimes the best question can be why. Mm. I know that sounds bizarre, but you should. For years, I would never just, if someone says, you know, I'm not really feeling it at the moment, if you just go, why? Mm. You know, then you just let them talk. I think it takes a long time from the presenters that I look up to. You learn from them that less is more. You know, it's not about me. It's not about Hazel Irvine, who I think is a fantastic presenter. It's just about the subject on the couch. And you do have to judge it. Listen, we're lucky that it's a sport and we get the winners on the couch. So yeah. 9 times out of 10, yeah. they're going to be pretty happy.
Yeah.
But, yeah, there are some questions that I once with Ryan Day, it was, came on the couch, and I thought he didn't play a great game of snooker. I thought it was a bit boggy. The match wasn't that great to watch. And I think my first question to him, this is about 2 years ago, was not the best game of snooker, but you got through. And then he was like, no, I thought I played really well. Mm. And I was like, and, you know, there's a very fine line between me wanting to say to him, what are you talking about? That was garbage. And me going, you know, you are 100% right. You know, that's your view. You played in it. I didn't. Who am I to? Mm. So, yeah, you have got to judge it. But as I say, I'm, you know, 9 times out of 10, the people that sit on the couch have just won. Mm. So if they're not, maybe I'll say, what's the matter with you? Just won.
The other thing I think it's important to say that I think people may not realise is, there's no auto cue. You know, I think people assume you're just reading when you come on and sort of sign off the programme, you're reading the script. You're not, are you? And you're having to judge the count in your ear and whatever else is being said.
Yeah.
You know, that takes quite a lot of getting used to.
Yeah, I've worked with auto cue and it's horrible because I can't read. For years, when I was doing Soccer AM, the whole show, when you've got like a magazine show, usually it's auto cue because it's link. And the whole show was auto cued. And I used to do the Friday night show for 4 years and then the Saturday show for a year. And when I started on the Saturday show, so I've done 4 years, I kept just mucking up on the auto cue, like just stumbling on words. And then one day a new woman come in who controls the auto cue from the gallery, who makes it go up as you're reading it, and she said, why is it all in block caps? And I was like, what do you mean? And she went, auto cue should be. And I was like, well, how, why, what difference does it make? And she said, because your brain will subconsciously see the shape of the word before you say it. I was like, all right, why has no one ever told me that in 4 years? And it's just little things like that, you know. But I much prefer ad-libbing, because then that way I can't go wrong.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they're my words that are coming out of my mouth. So I'll say, yeah, I was going to say that. I was meant to say. But, yeah, listen, it's a difficult job, but it's like anything. You know, my mate's an electrician. I can't do that. My mate works in a bank. I couldn't do that. So I can't do what you do. Actually, I probably could do it.
Anyone could do this.
Yeah.
Okay, well, one thing that I think not anyone could do is try and keep, you know, Ronnie and Jimmy are big characters, and they're not necessarily media trained, particularly Jimmy. I think you know, when you do the table demonstrations and so on, it's kind of compulsive viewing because you're not quite sure what's going to happen. And we were doing one today where Jimmy was playing the masse shot and he had his jacket on. It was really, really difficult.
Yeah.
But, you know, you've come from being a kid idolising Jimmy to now trying to marshal him basically on air. What's that like?
I know, his babysitter. yeah, it can be frantic sometimes. I think it's bizarre. I don't know what you think, though, but I think I get a different Jimmy at that mid-session when Ronnie's there and when he's not. Mm. And I don't know if it's because when Ronnie's there and he's trying to recreate a shot, he feels a little bit more pressure because, you know, he looks up to Ronnie as well, you know, he appreciates just, you know, how much of a fantastic player he is, and he wants to perform his best, where I think when he's with just me and Neil, he knows he can have a laugh. But either way, it's great. I mean, it's what a lot of people don't see is when we're in that break, going to it or also leaving it, they then keep practising it.
Yeah.
You know, the Masso shot you talked about today, Ronnie just wouldn't put the cue down. He's trying and trying and trying, and then Jimmy's standing next to him and Jimmy's telling Ronnie how to hit the cue ball. Ronnie's having it a go, and then they change and Jimmy takes his jacket off. You know, they're the things you don't see. Mm. But I like the fact that Jimmy isn't media trained, and I like the fact he doesn't know where the cameras are. No, genuinely, I think it's funnier. You know, I always think as a snooker fan, what would I like to see? Mm. And I like the rawness of that. I want to see Jimmy get in the way, because it's compulsive viewing, you know. It's one of those things where the mid-session interval is usually the place to go and make a cup of tea. Mm. But I would like to think, because of that mayhem and chaos, it's the place where you go, actually, I might make the cup of tea when the next frame starts. Mm.
And also, we've all seen pundits in various sports who are very measured and they say kind of quite bland things. Those two, particularly Jimmy, they say Jimmy doesn't even know he's on air half the time, but
yeah,
they say the same things when the cameras are off as
yes,
when they're on. They're themselves, which is what you want when you've got big personalities.
Yeah, and also Jimmy will say things that just leave his mind and come out of his mouth. You know, you're right, there are other organisations, I won't name them, but are quite stiff when they broadcast, and maybe that's the old way, the old school of how snooker, I think, was and I grew up with. But I think that the snooker fan now is a lot more laid back, a lot more casual, likes a bit of fun. I hate the word, but I'll say it, likes a bit of banter. Mm. And they definitely provide it.
What's changed in the time you've been presenting is social media's come along and people can have connection with you, can have back and forth. That can be good and bad, as we know. How, I mean, you're quite prolific on Instagram and Twitter. How have you found that? Because inevitably, not everyone's going to be a fan, and not everyone is necessarily.
Why? What are you talking about? What have you read?
Well, no, what I was going to say was not everyone is necessarily that stable either.
You know, okay.
But you get all sorts of people. How do you sort of, do you just take the rough with the smooth, or do you just accept it all?
I have four people that look after my Instagram account. You know what? I used to, when I first got onto social media, I used to look at every comment and I used to believe everything that was written and really take it to heart. You can't do that nowadays, because 9 times out of 10, if people like something, they don't go on social media, and if they hate it, they will. I don't use it as much as I used to. I tend now to Instagram pictures and put that onto my Twitter feed. But if someone sends something that's nice or they ask a question, I'll happily reply to it. But social media can be a horrible world, you know. Even if you just tweet a picture of, well, I tweeted something the other day. I can't even remember what it was. I tweeted a picture the other day of like my breakfast, and someone put, I can't believe you have 2 eggs. And it's like, just look at the, just don't comment about anything that's negative, you know? So it's not worth it. But listen, I tweet other people that I don't know. I don't have a problem with people, you know, tweeting. It's absolutely fine. It's a good way to connect. Someone tweeted me the other day, going back to what we were saying before about mistakes I used to make on Sky Sports, someone tweeted me the other day, video footage of me making a mistake this week. Mm. Not a big one.
Nice of them.
Yeah, thanks for that, Dave.
And
I just replied with, like, you know, the little emoji of the monkey with his hands over his face. Yeah. There's nothing you can do. I don't mind it. If people feel that there's some kind of connection there, that's cool. Mm. It's when they tweet pictures of them in their pants watching the snooker. You've got to stop doing that, Dave.
Yeah, I was going to say, again, I was bored. But of course, if you throw football into the mix as well, then you do get, it can be quite toxic. And that brings us to your Talk Sports show. You do the Sports Bar every night. And
Monday to Thursday from 10 p.m.
Indeed. And that's obviously a lot of football in that. Tell us firstly how that came about, that show.
So I used to do, the first time I went on to Talk Sport was 2 Euros ago. So when would that have been, Dave? Where are we now? 2018. So it would have been 2016, 2012.
2012, yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
No, it would have been... Hold on. I'll tell you when it was. I first went to TalkSport 10 years ago, because that's when my eldest was born. There you go. I first went to TalkSport 10 years ago, and it was just after I'd got the boot from Soccer AM, and it was a godsend. It was literally one day there was a phone call saying, we're not going to renew your contract, and the next day saying, do you want to come and work for TalkSport? I'd never done radio before. It was fantastic. I was probably thrown in the deep end. But I used to do a show that was Saturday and Sunday nights, and no one listened to it, and we got away with absolute murder. And then what they used to do on TalkSport, at 10 o'clock, they used to have a guy called Ian Collins who did Current Affairs, and then the old director of programmes at TalkSport, a guy called Moz D, suddenly thought, well, we're called Talk Sport, but at 10 o'clock we don't talk about sport. We talk about, you know, why are the bins not being collected in Camden or something on a Tuesday? And then he just said, do you want to do every night of the week after the game's finished? And it just made complete sense. You know, 10 o'clock, the big game's just finished. You know, Monday's Premier League, Tuesday, Wednesday, Champions League, Thursday, Europe. Why is there not a phone in? And I was like, yeah, fine, great. And then for the lot, so that was 7 years ago we started doing that, me and Jason Cundy. And again, it's radio. There is absolutely no script with that. There is no running order. And the great thing about it, Dave, is there's no prep, as in preparation, because we just sit in the office at 8 o'clock, we watch the game, whatever it is, Champions League, and then we react to it. And then we have all of tomorrow's newspapers, the back pages, and various guests that come on as well. And I absolutely adore it. It's a 3-hour show, and it is fantastic. I love television. I love radio as much. It's great fun.
But what's noticeable as well, you know, you're not the BBC where you have to be balanced and have to be, oh, we're going to hear this side of it and that. You basically say what you want.
Yes, I can. And some people don't get that. Some people phone up and go, why are you so one-sided? And I say, because I'm a football fan. We've talked many a time about the fact that I'm a United fan, of course, being from London. And when, like, Liverpool playing in the Champions League or Chelsea or whoever, well, not Chelsea, they're not in it this year. I will say, you know, I don't want Liverpool to win. I don't want Chelsea. How can you say that? You're meant to. And I'm like, well, do you want Manchester United to win? You're a Chelsea fan. Do you? And it's that, you know, primarily I am a football fan and I'm doing a radio show. And I love the fact that I've got complete and utter freedom. Yeah. Although the first year I was doing it, I did get in trouble. because what I didn't realise about radio is people don't sit in front of it like they do with the telly and listen constantly. They dip in and out. And Jason Cunningham, my co-host, couldn't do a show one night, and as a joke, I said, sadly, he can't be here because he died in a freak yachting accident, right? This is awful. Yeah. And so people like cabbies, listen or whatever, would just hear Jason Cundy's died. That's all they hear. Yeah. And it got to a stage that night, it's awful, Dave. It got to a stage where people started laying reeds outside Stamford Bridge, right? And I didn't know Jason that well. And he'd just got over testicular cancer, Again, I didn't know. Thankfully, he's fine.
It's not getting any better, is it?
No, it gets worse. So his mum woke up to voice messages of people crying, saying, "Oh my God, I'm so sorry to hear about Jason."
Wow.
Yeah. That wasn't... I remember the director of programmes phoned me up, and he goes, "Everyone's going crazy. The board phoned me up saying, am I going to sack you? What should I tell him?" And I went, just say, no, I'm not. And thankfully he didn't, and I didn't make that mistake again.
I suppose one thing, though, is, it, you know, in terms of just your sort of body clock almost, 10 to 1, it's not... Most people would not regard those as working hours.
It's not the worst, you know. It does sound a bit crazy. I have all day at home.
Yeah.
If I'm not working during the day, but, you know, 9 times out of 10, I can go to the gym, I can go out for lunch with my wife, I can, you know, play snoop with my pals or play golf or whatever. And then I leave for work, I get in, I see the kids, you know, I can pick them up from school. I then get to work at 8, I watch the football, I leave work at 1, I'm home by 1:30 in the morning, which is not too bad. Mm. Go straight to bed. My wife is up in the morning with the kids. She takes them to school. I'm up about 9:30. I've got the whole day again. So if it was a 2:30 finish, something like that, it would be a bit of a killer. But I don't get used to it. People say I haven't got used to it. I'm still a bit tired, but there's not jet lag in it. I'm just a little bit.
In terms of the future, do you have your sort of sights set on any particular sort of further challenges in broadcasting?
I'd like to present the World Snooker Awards one day again, Dave.
Yeah, you did do that. And it was kind of, for people who weren't there, if you think back to when Ricky Gervais did the Golden Globes.
That's a compliment.
No, yeah, and not everyone in that audience was happy with the things he was saying, and I think it was slightly similar in your case.
Yes, I'd like to get that back one day, Barry, if you're listening. Yeah. Although my fee will go up. What would I like to... It's a good question. Do you know what? I know it sounds bizarre. Whatever comes along, great, but I'm extremely lucky. I do all the home nations for Eurosport. We're going to Germany together. We're doing the shootout.
For the snooker, I should
say. For the snooker, yeah.
Not just going on holiday.
No, we're going out. Oh, I didn't know there was an event there. I thought it was just a hotel romantic weekend. I do the radio stuff. I work for MUTV, so on match days I'm at Old Trafford. I can't, you know, life couldn't be any... Financially it could be. But
you've got to be enthusiastic, haven't you? Because I think, again, we know people in the media who act as if like there's a gun to their head. But when you look at it, I mean, it's a great job, isn't it?
It's not a job.
But you've got to be coming and think, I really want to be here because this is good stuff.
Oh, yeah, without a doubt. Do you consider it a job?
Sometimes. Depends on the match.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, fair enough. But it's not, is it? As I said before, my mates have got proper jobs. Yeah. You know, and even my mates that are really well off and financially secure for life, They still have crazy jobs. They travel the world, you know, they find it a ball ache. Can I say ball ache?
You just said it.
Okay.
You said it twice, actually.
They find it a ball ache three. Sometimes, you know, they've got families and they don't... I'm extremely lucky that I do something I absolutely adore. I get to hang out with my idols. I'm looking at Dave. And get paid for it as well. But what would I like to do? One day, maybe host match of the day. That'd be quite nice. Maybe that.
Yeah.
Football focus.
Yeah.
Saying a lot of Beeb stuff, aren't I?
Yeah.
After I slaughtered Barbara Slave at those awards, I don't think that's going to happen.
Well, listen, Andy, I'll let you go because you've got to rehearse your ad-libs for tonight. So, but thanks a lot for being on the podcast, and good luck for the rest of the season here on Eurosport, the home nations, and indeed Germany. And Merry Christmas.
Yes, and I'll see you at our usual hotel in Germany.
Yeah, then. And just plug your show again. Tell us when it's
on. Thank you. It's very kind. It's Monday to Thursday on TalkSport from 10 p.m.
Cheers, Andy.
Thanks, Dave.